So look, I realize I am a man of biases, right? But the late 80s to early 90s in motorsports were the best. I was born in 84, so like I said, you know, biases. But I think that the stuff that you would have had a poster of on your wall when you were a kid, that sort of is the stuff that stays with you. Especially for something like a race car, you know, because like, you know, when you're a kid, it's kind of when you feel most strongly, I think, about how cool that stuff is. And so like modern race cars, we all know, right? They're technical and aerodynamic marvels. They are astoundingly good, just almost too good, really. But like, just, I don't know, man, like give me a brick shaped something boosted to the moon that sets incredible lap times through sheer tyranny of will. Every time over, you know, like a semen-shaped hybrid that breaks the sound barrier down Mulsanne while powered by nothing more than a 17-horsepower Briggs & Stratton V-twin. You know, the cars of the 80s and 90s, they didn't exploit physics like the cars of now because they didn't understand it well enough. What the cars of the 80s and 90s did to physics was closer, I think, to a mugging. You know, the car is slow, add horsepower. Oh, we can't get the power down. Put bigger tires on it. Yeah, the bigger tires didn't do it. You know what? Let's just add more drive wheels. It'll be fine. The car will be through the turn and halfway down the next straight before physics notices that it's missing its wallet. Now, there's a saying that goes like this, and you've all heard it if you're here. There's no replacement for displacement. It's a good saying, or really it was until the introduction of forced induction, which is more or less a direct replacement for displacement. Lots of manufacturers experimented with it earlier, if you wanted. In fact, you could buy a turbocharged Chevrolet Corvair in 1962. But in the 1980s and 1990s, there really was not anybody doing a better job of just making asinine levels of power, thanks to the magic of turbocharging, than Nissan. You know, Electromotive's GTP ZX Turbo, Bob Sharp's 280ZX's, Cunningham's IMSA 300ZX, and NPTI's later GTP and Group C cars. Nissan really did like their spoolie boys. But as much as I'd like to talk about these cool old Nissans, and I definitely will cover the GTP ZX Turbo at the very least for an episode, since I'm like reading a whole book about it, I'm only here to talk about one car today. I'm here to tell you folks about Godzilla. That means we are here to talk about the Group A R32 Nissan Skyline GTR. So a thing about me is, if you're going to call a race car Godzilla, and I'm going to do a podcast talking about it, I'm going to put a Godzilla sound somewhere in the podcast. That was just sort of something that happened. So if you liked it, great. If not, well, what are you going to do? Anyway, welcome back to the Race Car Podcast, a show that I record whenever I feel like it. This episode, for example, is being recorded after I felt like getting my microphone fixed, which in fact I never actually did. I broke the USB port out of the microphone a while ago. I opened it up to try to fix it. I made it worse, which made me lose interest. Then I regained interest. I lost it again. I bought Gran Turismo 7. I regained interest. I started writing, and then I just ended up buying a new microphone. So my creative process really just boils down to chaos. Today's subject, though, is a car I've been into for a while, probably since the first Gran Turismo launched, 95, 96, 97, I forget exactly when the first game, I think 97, 95 seems early, because as an American, Gran Turismo 1 was really sort of the first time that most of us were exposed to the Nissan Skyline. You know, we got the Supra and we got the RX-7 here, we got the Mitsubishi GTO in the form of the 3000 GT and the Dodge Stealth, and we, you know, we got a form of the Nissan Silvia, which is not quite in that, you know, supercar, you know, space like the other ones are, in the form of the 240SX. And we got all manners of Nissan Z cars, but we never got the Skyline. And frankly, I still really don't get it. But so we're all sort of like, what is this thing? It's this kind of big coupe. It has a twin turbo inline six and all-wheel drive and just absolutely rips. Like, why haven't we heard of this? And so, yeah, I mean, it's still just nuts to me that we never got the GTR here until the R35 came in 2007, by which point they didn't even call it a Skyline anymore because it wasn't one. So, I mean, R32s and R33s, you know, you see those. At least where I live in Rhode Island, there's a bunch of R32s I see around constantly. And I guess the earliest R34s are now federally legal. In fact, there's a guy on Facebook Marketplace right now selling an R34 GTT for $70,000, if you're into that sort of thing. So it's always been kind of a fascination of mine, this sort of forbidden and exotic automotive fruit. Luckily, the R32 GTR, though, it isn't just numbers on a spreadsheet good, which it certainly is, but this is... Like, I've talked about dominant race cars on this show. I think it probably at this point is the top flavor of subject. Maybe even more so than abject failures. But in a world of Porsche 917s and Corvette C5Rs, the Group A R32 Skyline does need to be in that conversation for the most dominant. And as we'll talk about, its success wasn't even just limited to its home country of Japan. The R32 administered just... thorough beatings wherever it went, but we can't talk about the R32 without talking about Australia. So without any further exposition, I guess, I'm calling this one King of the Monsters, Group A Nissan Skyline GTR R32. So this is the Race Car Podcast. Let's get into it. So in the 80s, Nissan was by no means new to racing, and realistically, neither was the Skyline. So earlier models of the car, like the C10 Skyline, won many JTCC championships. In fact, even the R32's direct predecessor, the R31 GTSR, won the 86 and 89 JTCC Drivers' Championship, so the car was really no slouch. But so the R31 featured a 2-liter inline-six called the RB20 DETR. At a 5-speed transmission, limited slip diff, I mean, you know, pretty standard. Car also had an all-wheel steering system called HiCAS, which is short for High Capacity Active Controlled Steering. But at its best, in race trim, the R31 would make 400, you know, maybe a little more than 400 horsepower, so they were always down on power compared to their main competition, which was Ford's Sierra Cosworth. So the Sierra, better known throughout the annals of history as the Mercer XR4 Ti, was a coupe built by Ford, and the race model, the RS500, was an evolution of the road-spec Sierra RS Cosworth. Also front engine, rear drive, 2-liter 4-cylinder turbo, standard stuff. So Ford had to build 500 homologation cars, and they were converted from standard Sierra RS Cosworths by Tickford. And they featured some kind of neat things. They had a second fuel rail and second set of fuel injectors, which I believe were inoperable on the road cars. Obviously bigger turbo and intercooler, and they had a lower element on the wing to go with the classic upper whale tail spoiler that they had. Additionally, and I think this is cool, Aussie team owner Dick Johnson managed to get a version of the Ford 9-inch rear axle homologated for use in the car, which really let them actually beat the shit out of the thing because, like, it's a 9-inch. If it's good enough to go behind a Cobra Jet, it's good enough to go, you know, behind the Sierra RS500's 2-liter. So in Group A trim, the cars would make in excess of 500 horsepower versus about a 2,500-pound curb weight. The RS500 was, all in all, a phenomenally successful race car and won everything, everywhere, all over the world. Funnily enough, though, I did 4 or 5 minutes of research on the RS500, and I discovered that the first ever Sierra Group A touring car was actually a Mercer XR4 Ti. So while I thought I was being snarky, I was actually being informative. So I apologize for the error. It will not happen again. So what it kind of came down to was Ford built more of like a purpose-built race car and then homologized it for the street. And Nissan, you know, the R31, I don't know. It wasn't serious like that, right? So Ford had won at that time back-to-back-to-back JTCC championships from 87 to 89. And to paraphrase Michael Jordan, Nissan took that personally. And I gotta say, I really respect, just as a hater, right? I respect Nissan's approach to overcoming this. They looked at it, and instead of deciding, you know, to improve incrementally everywhere, or maybe just improve in one big key area, Nissan just sort of decided they would simply make their car better than everybody else's in every area to you know, pretty ridiculous degrees. Nissan was not there to play. They were there to win. And they were there to build a no-nonsense killer of a car. And so, really, that starts under the hood with the new engine. It was enlarged to 2.6 liters. It was called the RB26DETT. You'll notice that has two T's in it, as opposed to the RB20DETR's one. And that means exactly what you think it does. Two T's, two turbos. Now, I like to imagine at one point there was an RB26DETTT on the drawing board. But, you know, they felt, you know what, two turbos, I think we've made our point. So the RB26DETT supplied by Nismo to their customers made right around 500 horsepower. I'm sure some of the factory teams, Calsonic and whatnot, they had to have been making more than that. But, I mean, we'll talk about some, let's call it healthier power figures a little bit later on in the show. So at the time in Group A, tire width in the class was limited to 11 inches. So Nissan did the reasonable thing and decided to drive all four wheels so they could make just apocalyptic levels of power and still put it all to the ground. Maintaining that sensible approach to developing the system, Nissan went and they purchased the Porsche 959, as you do. And again, I enjoy the idea of the conversation with the engineer walking into the boss's office, and he explains what they want to do with, you know, the all-wheel drive and all that stuff. And the boss says, well, who makes the best all-wheel drive system? The engineer thinks about it and says, well, Porsche's 959 is certainly the top car right now. And his boss opens the desk drawer and throws 32 million yen at him and directs him to the nearest Porsche store. Because realistically, there's no sense messing around, is there? Anyway, as I said, Porsche's 959 all-wheel drive system was widely regarded as the best in the world at the time, even better than Audi's Quattro system. So the Audi used a locking center diff, Porsche used a multi-plate clutch between the transmission and the front diff, which controlled where the torque went. Audi was usually right around 50-50 front-rear torque split. Porsche favored 40-60, which mirrored the car's weight distribution, but Porsche's system never supplied less than 20% of the torque to the front axle. Porsches of the 80s and earlier had kind of a reputation for wanting to murder their dentist drivers, and Porsche wanted the 959 to feel safer, which sending 20% of the torque to the front axle did help. So Nissan's system was called ATESA ETS, and I'm going to tell you what that stands for because I think it's worth saying. ATESA ETS, well, a very long acronym, is reasonably short for Advanced Total Traction Engineering System for All Terrains and Electronic Torque Split. Speaking of torque split, remember how I just said Porsche sent no less than 20% to the 959's front axle at any given time? Well, ATESA ETS supplied the front axle with exactly 0% of torque until it was needed. So Porsche, they used data from wheel speed sensors and the engine speed. Nissan added three G sensors to the car and also took data from the ABS system. This allowed them to change the torque characteristics in all phases of the car's movement, from limiting front torque on turn-in to adding torque to the front axle under heavy braking to increase engine braking performance. Nissan debuted the system in 1989 and has basically kept at it since, with ATESA ETS Pro debuting on the R33 GTR and a version persisting into today's R35. So, I mean, you know, pretty good all-wheel drive system, right? So Nissan combined that with their high-cast rear steering system on the R32 to try and limit the understeer inherent in a 3,000-pound all-wheel drive race car. Well, Nissan's Japan-based racers did that. Things went differently in Australia, but we will get to that in a little bit. So I think if there's any one thing that most contributed to the kind of turbo takeover that occurred in motorsports from the 70s to the 90s, it has to be engine parity rules. If you're naturally aspirated, you can be, say, 4.5 liters. And if you're turbocharged, you can only be 2.6. The effectiveness of turbocharging wasn't understood as fully as it is today. And so for that reason, it was able to be exploited, same as it was by a car like the Audi 90 GTO I talked about a while back. With enough dollars, you can just cram several atmospheres of pressure into whatever engine you want, at which point turbocharging becomes not just a replacement for displacement, but in fact an improvement upon it. So, from what I can tell, since I've been having trouble finding exact figures, though this car did not actually run massive levels of boost. Stock R32 GTR boost is 0.8 bar, which equates to 11.6 PSI. Rick Wood, who's R32s you've heard in my audio clips here, he built a bolt-perfect recreation of the Calsonic R32, and on 1.2 bar, which is 17.4 PSI, that car makes 650 horsepower. Now, of course, he can also run that particular car at 2 bar, which is 29 PSI, and make like 1,000 horsepower. So I wouldn't be shocked, though, if, you know, because that car does, I'm sure, have some modern, you know, stuff in the engine. If the period cars were having to run a little bit more than that 1.2 bar to make their 600 horsepower. So how did Nissan's all-in attitude work out? Well, I mean, good enough that we're recording a podcast about it, right? So JTCC 1990 is the first season for the car. The season was 6 races long and saw 6 wins for the R32 GTR. 5 from Calsonic, who were the eventual championship winner, and the other race was won by Hasemi. 1991, 6 wins from 6 races. This time Hasemi wins the championship. 92, 8 wins in 8 races. Hasemi's champion again. 93 was the last JTC season to run under Group A rules, and it was a real change of pace with Nissan winning 9 of the 9 races and Calsonic taking their second championship win. So for 1994, JTCC would become a super touring series. You know, think British Touring Car Championship, you know, like the Volvo 850 wagon that I did the episode about. And the top 93 class would move to a whole different series, the All Japan Grand Touring Car Championship, or JGTC, which is what would eventually become the series that we know today as Super GT. So JGTC's 94 season was only 5 races, and the cars included were a hodgepodge in the absolute most beautiful way. So it's a compromise of 2 classes, which at the time was GT1 and GT2, and those would eventually become GT500 and GT300 respectively. But let's just take a look at a few of the top class GT1 entries, because I think it's a lot of fun. So Calsonic's R32 were there, and so were Zexel Nismo and Hasemi for the guys out there running their R32 Godzillas. As an aside, actually, Hasemi at this point had stopped running all-wheel drive. Their R32 was a straight rear-wheel drive racer. Team Le Mans was there with a Nissan as well, but not a Skyline. They built their own Fairlady ZLM, which to me looks like a fish. I don't think it's a particularly attractive Z car. Toyota Team Sard brought Supra, and so did Blitz. Hunter and Acom Team Nova came with Porsche 964s, which is a perfectly reasonable car to enter. The Lunatics at Ross Competition decided a Lancia 037 was a reasonable car to enter here. Ken Wolf with Terray Engineering brought a Lamborghini Countach 25th anniversary. And I haven't even gotten to the team that I'm writing this section for, which is Team Taisan, those absolute beauties. They entered a pair of Ferrari F40 LMs and a Porsche 962. Yeah, a 962 that alternated starts with one of the F40s. And they didn't just show up with these things, right? So the 962 actually won round 3 at Mount Fuji, and the number 40 F40 won round 5 at Mine Circuit, which I'm almost certain isn't, but it does sound like a Mario Kart track. But we're talking R32 Skyline here, so I am pleased to report that even racing against an F40 and one of the most successful sports prototypes of all time, the Calsonic GTR won the championship from Hasemi and Racing Team Nakaharu, who were also running R32 GTRs. This would be the last full season for the R32, with the R33 GTR coming online to replace it partway through 95. I was looking at the races on YouTube. It is awesome, by the way, that all the 95 JGTC races are available as their original Japan broadcasts on YouTube. God bless YouTube. The R33 is in use by Team Jomo right from the first race, but Calsonic, Hasemi, and the other Nissan teams would stick with the R32 for the first race. And in fact, Calsonic would be rewarded as they would shithouse one final win for the R32 at round 1 at Suzuka. Hasemi would win in round 4, which would be the first win for the R33. So 35 races total for the R32 over 6 seasons in Japan, and it would win 32 of them, which is just banana land numbers. But like we said, Japan was not the only place the R32 was winning at the time. So Nissan farmed their Australian operation out to Gibson Motorsport, also called Nissan Motorsport Australia. They ran the R31 Skyline to very good levels of success. They even won the 90 Drivers' Championship, with their R32 not coming into use until partway through the season. So Gibson, though, had a different approach to the GTR. Most notably, they did not even try to use the high-cast rear-wheel steering system. What they did do, though, was they modified their Atessa ETS all-wheel drive system with different modes. And apparently, even the Nissan bosses were fairly impressed by that. Mode 1, full rear-wheel drive. Mode 2, regular all-wheel drive. Mode 3, all-wheel drive, but with more front dialed in for when the tires were going off. interestingly, Mode 1, rear-wheel drive, was for the race starts because all-wheel drive launches were difficult given the car's weight. There's a fun story from Fred Gibson about his cars that I'm just going to read directly from the article I found in Which Car. He said, we went to take our car to Mount Fuji one year to race in the Fuji 1000. The promoters invited us over, all expenses paid. I thought that sounded pretty trick, but I got a phone call from the boss of Nissan, Mr. Kakamoto. He said, Gibson, I believe you're coming to Fuji. This is not a good idea. You do Australia and New Zealand. We do Japan and the Asian races. He says, why is that? He said, Gibson, your cars are too quick. We don't want to race our cars against yours. Gibson says, they supplied race-ready engines to privateers with 500 horsepower. Ours had 625. We would have blown the socks off of them. So Gibson's GTR is sponsored by Winfield to the tune of $5 million a year. Man, do I miss cigarette sponsorship money in racing, guys. They would win 16 of their 27 races, and also the 91 and 92 championships. The 92 championship is particularly impressive because of all the work being done to limit the cars. In 91, they were running that 650-ish horsepower that Fred Gibson mentioned, and for 92, they had to run blow-off valves that limited them to less than 500, along with weight penalties. The GTR would only win 4 of the 9 races, but Mark Scaife would still win the championship. For 93, unfortunately, the rules moved on to 5-liter V8 engines as the top class, and Gibson, now called Winfield Racing Team, switched to the Holden VP Commodore, though Ford would go on to win the championship with their Falcon. And that basically covers the racing career of the R32 and its ridiculous levels of success. Its successors, R33 through 35 inclusive, would all go on to win JGTC or Super GT races and championships. In fact, the only Nissan GTR I can think of that was not a smashing success, unfortunately, was my guy, the 2015 GTR LM Nismo, which I guess is kind of a GTR in name only. And if you do want to know why that particular car didn't work, and if you haven't listened to it yet, go check out my episode on it, because I actually really enjoyed doing that one. So that about does it for this episode of the Race Car Podcast. I've been thinking a little bit about what to do for the next one, although, frankly, if I'm one of you guys listening to this, I wouldn't blame you at the least for hearing me talk about what I'm going to do next, and you're like, all right, great, we'll see it in 2024. I'm thinking about the Lotus 56. You know, the turbine car. I've been looking at it a little bit. I was thinking either that or maybe the Mazda 787B. I think that one's probably been talked about a lot. The Sauber C9. Or another one I came up with that I thought would be good with this is the Panos GTR1. Because that was kind of a weird car. And, you know, I like weirdos. But I'm leaning Lotus 56. I think that's probably where I'm heading next. Also going to be back this year, I think, with Stalled Arrow, a Formula One show that I do with my buddy Bernie. And I don't know, I'm thinking I might start doing, you know, just short news shows. Probably not Formula One reactions or anything like that, but, you know, just like when a story comes out, you know, I might post something somewhere. But if I do that, you know, I don't know if there'll be any crossover with this, but who knows. So anyway, guys, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. You know, sticking with me for, probably about a year or so since I last did an episode. But I don't know, hopefully it'll be a shorter wait in between this episode and my next one. So thanks for listening, guys. Appreciate you. Latest.